Greetings, salutations. Welcome to another Hempisode of Hemp Aware Radio. This is your Hemptrepreneurial host, Tyler Hemp, here to Hemppower and Hempducate your Hemposphere as usual. I'm super stoked to have lifelong friends. We originally met back in like 2005. This is Denny Fennerin. He's one of the original OG Hempsters. And I'm super stoked to have you here, buddy.
All right. Hey, thanks for considering having the show here in this spot out here in the Sonoran Desert, you know, where I live. It's wonderful. And it's wonderful that you're down here with me now.
Yeah, super stoked to be here. My intention for this Hempisode is to not only talk about Denny's history, what he's done for the industry, talk a little bit about the plants behind us, and maybe even some current events like the latest legislation around industrial hemp.
Don't get me started.
What that means. So before we get into like current events, let's talk a little history here. Like, what are your roots, man? Like, what was it that led you up to cannabis and open up this whole world of creating Crucial Hemp and distributing, you know, hemp and cannabis products all over these years?
Well, you know, coming to planet Earth through my parents, you know, that was number one, I guess, you know. So I was born in Chicago to really loving, great parents. And then, you know, they've been there for a while. They got cold, moved to Miami. I did a little bit of education in Miami, you know, learned Spanish, you know, and down in Miami, and, you know, there's a lot of Caribbean culture I was exposed to. Lived up that street not far from the Marleys even, but, you know, started smoking weed, you know, right around 13, you know, getting exposed to it and stuff. And, you know, most of that was like, you know, old school, you know, I mean, talk about smuggler dudes, man. Those guys back in the day, you know, had, you know, big square groupers and stuff coming to Florida. Every now and then a friend would find one washed up on the beach, you know, pressed to cannabis and salt water and stuff. So that was a...
What year do you think that was around?
I'm going to say 80, earlier 80s, you know. Okay. I mean, that's, yeah, kind of. I was born in 69, so that's going to make it probably, you know, 84, 83, okay, something like that. I wouldn't know exactly, but yeah, that would have been the first kind of cannabis, you know.
Okay. So you were introduced to more of the recreational.
That, yeah, 100%. So, you know, got behind that hook, line, and sinker. Really enjoyed the way that made me feel. Got into the Grateful Dead early on. So a lot of people can give their, you know, brains a healthy thanking for what the Grateful Dead provided to the whole, you know, culture at large, you know, basically trying to, you know, explore through music, certainly, you know, and the use of, you know, of course, psychedelics and different things. And then cannabis was always kind of a part of that culture and how it made you feel. And, you know, with music and dance and just part of, you know, of course, recreationally using cannabis, you know, I knew when I first tried it that there's something special and mysterious about the plant. And I also knew that there was something terribly wrong with the way that it was outlawed, you know, and so many people over the course of, you know, human history have suffered tremendously as a result of other people's, you know, oppression, of it. And, you know, it really boils down to greed, you know, is what it boils down to. And people and control and power, you know, ultimately greed, you know. Yeah. So, but yeah, you know, always involved in cannabis culture, being in the South. I came out here to Arizona to do college, really, because it was going to be closer to where I could see Grateful Dead shows, because down in Miami, they didn't get down there too much. And from here, you know, California is just there. You can be in Southern California shows and go up to the Bay Area. I mean, that was the driving force, you know. Yeah. The first day in Arizona, I saw a Grateful Dead concert here. You know, I kind of planned it out that way. So, and then through that connection and just connection of people, got involved with activism and early on was introduced to Jack Hare. And, you know, I really owe it to Jack to have so eloquently expressed why marijuana was illegal, and marijuana was illegal because of this plant here, and the greedy forces that wanted to control their own industries that were going to get outcompeted by advancements in the production of different products from this plant, you know,
petrochemical,
right,
pharmaceutical.
Exactly.
So lumber.
Jack spelled it all out in his book, you know, The Emperor, and then he was out there tirelessly. He would come through Arizona a couple times a year, and, you know, he was always available to speak no matter where he had an opportunity, big crowd, little crowd, didn't matter, you know. And he was just out there educating. So I was so impressed by that. I kind of, you know, joined forces, let's say, with, you know, that group and then other groups. We have Arizona for Normal here. So I started kind of going to some of those meetings. And
National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws.
Right. And we had an Arizona chapter. I was even kind of separate from those guys on the national level. But okay. Anyways.
And real quick, Jack Hare, for those of you who likely don't know who he is, I'm sure most of you do. He wrote the book, as you said, The Emperor Wears No Clothes, kind of teamed up with Chris Conrad and organized all of the historical documentation of how hemp was a cash crop for centuries and ultimately became demonized and made illegal in the 1930s. And so this book, if you don't have a copy, definitely pick it up, The Emperor Wears No Clothes. But it outlines the Reefer Madness campaigns and how Andrew Mellon and Harry Anslinger and Hearst all got together to essentially demonize and make this plant illegal. So without going into too much
detail, and then when you're out there,
you got to hang out with him and be a part of that movement.
And we all, you know, we all very much enjoyed, you know, using marijuana recreationally. There wasn't a lot of access to industrial hemp in those days. There was the earliest guys I can think of were called House of Hemp, and then Joint Ventures was one of the earliest companies out there, and they made like a Levi style shirt, and it was called Joint Ventures was the name of the company, and I forget, God dang it, I can't remember the name of the shirt now. You know, big early on was like Ziggy Marley came out with one of those on Sesame Street. He was actually wearing one of their hemp shirts. Not that they talked about it or anything, but I happen to know the inside thing. And then, some of those early companies were supplying actually Willie Nelson back in those days. And then I got hooked up through, some of the earliest companies. That was probably the earliest. Then they started bringing it, and then there was House of Hemp, and Steve Orgel, I think was the guy's name, and he and this lady, Chinese lady, I think her name was Lucy, I can't remember exactly, but they brought some of the first containers in to supply that company, and then other people started buying the textiles, like I think Hempstead Company with Chris Boucher, Donnie Worshafter, of course, Ohio Hempery, really important to us here was Christine Bowling and Patrick, her husband. They had Coalition for Hemp Awareness down here in Arizona. And they were able to kind of work together to purchase, back in those days, I think it was mostly known to people. There was one warehouse called Dongping in China that was supplying everybody, you know? And so they, you know, the Coalition for Hemp Awareness worked together with Chris, if I'm not wrong. And you know, I think there was another American hemp mercantile out of Seattle. A couple other pretty profound guys. They were selling a lot of hemp twine, hemp twine and stuff in those
days.
This
was like 90s?
Yeah, early 90s. Yeah. So we're talking about 90, 92, 93. And then the Coalition for Hemp Awareness had this thing called the CHIC Conference, Cannabis Hemp Industrial Conference. I forget exactly. Okay. But we formed, I found out everybody's meeting, and in those days, those guys were collaborating on containers and stuff, but they really just wanted to talk about what was happening was hemp was starting to get to be hot. People were starting to notice this thing, hemp fabric, and of course, hemp twine. Everybody wanted to do bracelets back in those days. Yeah, exactly. But as it became available, there were some less scrupulous people bringing in kind of natural fiber stuff and calling it hemp, even though it was like sisal and some of these other kinds.
Flax?
Yeah. In fact, hemp was even used, like there's a thing called Manila hemp, and there was Manila hemp roll. I don't know if that's sisal or
true.
It's not true hemp. So then we, you know, got together to it was like kind of like an industry, what do you call
it? Movement.
Yeah, a movement to help regulate our own fabrics. So I actually was the first person to take over the testing for testing, you know, getting a HIA, Hemp Industry Association, certified. And not many people did it because it was like we were sending our textile samples into the Fashion Institute of Technology. There was a guy named Owen Circus that was an old-timey guy in the like a high-level professor at the Fashion Institute of Technology in New York City.
Yeah.
And he was a big proponent of cutting down on all the petrochemical waste in, mm-hmm. in the industry, because he had lived a long life in the industry and he knew the impacts of that the clothing industry is having on our planet. Right now, it's kind of devastating where all these clothes are winding up, and mostly mm-hmm. on the shores of Africa.
Yeah, which the, is also referred to as fast fashion.
Yeah, right? In the just form this... of goodwill. It's horrible. Like Africa, holy smokes, you know, is being exploited big time by people and in other parts of the world. And, mm-hmm. and it's kind of part of the great game now, but we're mm-hmm. kind of, you know, leaving them with a lot of our crap, you know, yeah. you know, unfortunately, you know.
So you started out with the cannabinoid side, got into more like consciousness expansion, psychedelics. You moved out to Arizona. You
right.
met Jack.
Yeah. So I started hemp company. Sorry. Yeah. I skipped ahead there. I started a hemp clothing company, basically, because we could get, it was, yeah, Crucial Creations Cannabis Clothing,
okay. yeah.
a little bit of a tongue twister, and then kind of simplifies it to Crucial Hemp, and
CCC.
Yeah. We were trying to be too clever.
Yeah.
So we brought it back to Crucial Hemp, which is a little Simplified. More street and a little, yeah. little cooler. So
I once went down that path. My organization was Human Exchange Musical Programs.
Yeah.
And then eventually, because of my marketing education, yeah. I just simplified it to Hempaware.
It's been an education. Let's just say that for sure.
Yeah. Hemp education.
The whole thing. But for yeah, sure. started okay. to dedicate my life to, you know, reintroducing. That was one of the key phrases that we came up with in those days. And with yeah. our little round table circle, you know, mm-hmm. putting the heads together. In those days, actually, Richard Lee and Steve D'Angelo were already going to the side and talking about how, you know, we're going to be selling this retail, actually marijuana. They mm-hmm. they set up like an after the industrial hemp meetings.
Yeah.
They set up their own thing to do that. And mm-hmm. it was really wonderful because that's ultimately where the revolution that now a lot of the world is enjoying recreational marijuana came from, the minds that were working towards, you know, the reintroduction of this plant on many, many levels.
Mm-hmm.
And the use of industrial hemp is just simply one of them.
Yeah.
And it still needs to be reintroduced because mm-hmm. you know, there's plenty that needs to happen with
yeah.
it, you know.
What would you say are some of the biggest misconceptions about this plant that are still circulating in human consciousness?
Well, I mean, There's so many, you know, like in human consciousness, especially conservative places, conservative countries, where people haven't had the exposure to the recreational or religious use of it, you know, the phobia around it is unfounded, you know, especially when so much of the world accepts a recreational alcohol and mm-hmm. and their apples and oranges are completely different. But the fact that we as a human race are willing to accept that there's such thing as a recreational use of alcohol, then by all means there needs to be a recreational use of cannabis because mm-hmm. of, you know, if it's about human health,
mm-hmm.
we can see alcohol being much more detrimental
yeah.
to human health than, mm-hmm. than cannabis. And that's proven
easily
upside.
Been documented and proven
over and over and over again. So
far more liver damage and
so somebody, yeah, so somebody's up to no good still, you know, and they don't have our best interests in mind when they want to prohibit this plant, you know, mm-hmm. at all, on mm-hmm. any level, you know. And that brings us to what's been currently happening. And
yeah.
what's been happening is, you know, millions of human beings collectively have spent millions of years in prison for this thing, you know,
yeah.
which is, you know, the biggest tragedy of
humanity.
Of humanity,
yeah.
really. So this needs to be addressed. I mean, people have lost mm-hmm. their lives mm-hmm. in other places for this, just in the judicial system. So, yeah, it's Jack always said that he would fight until his 80s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it was 81, 82, but him and his buddy, Ed, that they had this smoke shop in Venice, and they mm-hmm. came up with the whole concept of trying to expose this thing. And
he had a show called Time for Hemp, I think.
Is that what it is?
Yeah, so,
Captain Ed is
Captain Ed, yeah.
Captain Ed. So those guys had, you know, made a vow to stick with it until sometime mm-hmm. in their 80s, and then they'd be able to retire. So
yeah.
there's still a lot of work to do, and I feel like I could kind of try to sign up for that program too. So
mm-hmm.
you know, I want to reintroduce this. I just had a party here, actually, where people could come and see and walk around this, and people that I, you know, that I don't know, but, you know, it was kind of an open invitation through my Instagram account, which is some people thought that was a little nuts. But, I mean, hey, people need to see this. One of the most healing things about this plant is being with the plant as its living entity and, you know, experiencing the different, the different terpenes and the different just vibration that the plant gives off is amazing. I mean, this is amazing. And then, you know, it just wants to share with us right here. I can't think that some of these chemical compounds are just interacting with us as we just kind of chill here, you know?
Yeah,
what
it's
I mean?
Interesting that our cannabinoid system, we have an internal system that was named after this plant.
Right.
Most people don't know that.
Right.
And the word cannabis, the origin of it is canna as in canine, bis as in two.
Shout out to Two Star Dog.
Yeah.
Anyways.
And so some say the Dogon tribe in Africa claims that the cannabis plant originally comes from the Two Star system from Canis Major, which is Sirius.
Yes.
Sirius has a two star system. So the cannabis plant, the two dog plant comes from the two dog star in the constellation Canis Major. And the word cannabinoid is a conjugation of canna, bin, as in cannabis, and oid, which is a Greek word oidos, which means wisdom.
Okay.
So it's like these wisdom molecules that go into our system and literally affect every system, the major systems of the body, the immune system, the skeletal system, the nervous system, like, you know, the brain, the blood, like it can infuse and affect and bring wisdom to the cells for the whole body. So it's so fascinating that we have an internal system named after this plant.
Right, right.
So before we get into this specific field here, I want to ask you a little bit more about like hemp itself, the benefits, the value. Like, what do you think of all the uses from food, shelter, clothing, energy, plastics, medicine, fuel? What do you feel like is the one thing, if all of humanity could grasp the importance of this plant for one benefit or use, what do you think that would be?
Well, the coolest use that I heard, and I'm like a lay person, I'm not very scientific, and so it's hard for me to really explain what these guys are, or at least were doing at one point. It's definitely one of the neatest things I've heard about. Is it the best? I don't know. Can I go for two things that think are great? Right? Okay.
Yep.
I mean, there's so many great things. Uh-huh. I mean, thousands and thousands upon thousands of uses. Currently, it's being used for thousands of things. I mean, it's being used for mannequins. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Actually, they need hemp to build a mannequin. Mm-hmm. Go figure. No. What I think is the coolest that I heard about was there's a rare earth mineral called graphene.
Mm-hmm.
And graphene apparently is used in, I'm going to start using terms I don't understand. I hate doing that. But apparently, in the supercapacitor phase of storing energy in a battery,
mm-hmm.
on a molecular level, there's a substance called graphene where the electrons are able to be stored while they're not being discharged, and then they get discharged, and that's kind of how batteries work, mm-hmm. I guess. I don't really totally understand it.
Yeah.
But graphene is a thing that they use, and it's very, 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 very expensive, and it's caused a lot of destruction to mine it, apparently.
Mm.
Not graphite like the pencil, but graphene, right? Yeah. That's what we're talking about. And, of course, renewable energy is one of the things that we're going to need to get into for sure, because obviously at some point humans are going to run out of petrol, you know, this stuff, you know, under the ground.
Mm.
So what I've heard is that hemp fiber on a molecular level acts akin to the substance called graphene and can be used to actually store energy in batteries, and we can grow it as opposed to mine it.
Right.
I don't know how much we need or what, but that's a very cool use.
For sure.
For years energy everywhere is kind of an old saying, you know,
like get it all from the sun and
it's all energy, right? So
with the hemp.
I mean, look, I put these plants in the ground in this harsh desert here in the middle of the hottest part of the desert. We usually get a monsoon season, but I scattered these seeds in the middle of July, right? And you know, I didn't take
hot was it at
it was like 108 or something crazy, you know what I mean? But yeah, I scattered them around. I didn't put a lot of energy into it, but the plants gave us a lot of energy, which is amazing. And pretty short amount of time. I think we're just a few months after that now. So
yeah.
It's ready to harvest. It's given us all the seed, all the stuff. But
well, so what's the second thing?
Biomass, right? Hemp is hemp is a biomass. Like if we were growing this, now there's all this research been done. It takes less than cotton for fiber, all that, as far as water and nutrients and all this stuff. I mean, that's all semi-debatable until we really get really down with it and do a lot more studies, you know, because it hasn't been able to be studied for so long. So now we really need to do all that and figure out what's what. But there's certain parts of the country that are super suited to having a lot of this stuff, right? And there's a technique for making electricity called pyrolysis, where you use wood gas. In fact, there's all these plans, and then during World War II, all European countries were, you know, using wood gas, even for their motor vehicles and every other thing. So simply by using wood gas, we are actually making biochar. We're sequestering carbon while we're burning wood gas, right? And we're able to extract the energy that's being digested from the molecular decomposition of this crop that we could be growing, and then we could be using it to spin the wheel, as they say, to make electricity for our homes.
Interesting.
So I think that's an interesting thing to think
about. Yeah, I've asked that question to many hempsters over the years, and no one has said those two things. And what I love about what you're describing is they're both energy related.
Well, you know, we see how much energy we use. I use a ton, you know what I mean? Yeah. You know, myself personally.
Yeah.
So if we could be using plants and the sun and working with these plants to make energy for our needs, I mean, that's that's pretty huge, you know. The rest of it is great. You know, let's make clothing and
phytoremediation.
You know, let's smoke the stuff and have fun, all that. Sure. It's great, you know what I mean?
So. That's awesome. Okay, so to get into kind of what you're doing these days. Like you had Crucial Hemp, you had multiple projects over the years. You've been an incredible cannabis farmer and traveled the world growing cannabis all over.
Yes.
Like lately, what is it that you've been focused on that's really important to you?
Education of the local community here and getting people involved and being with it. And so this crop is almost like a demonstration thing, and I'm the director of the thing. And for me to be able to have people come here, see this and do it is wonderful. I'm also at the same time taking these all the way to seed. It's a variety from southern China and may or may not be the thing that's going to be, you know, carried on here in the desert, you know. So
in other words, the genetics may or may not be suited for this climate.
So we're trying to find out about all that kind of stuff, and now with the whole cannabinoid crisis and the
What do you mean by that?
The hemp bill, the hemp farm bill and all that, the redefinition of it.
Yeah.
It's probably, I bet you, even like the most benign fiber crop is probably going to wind up testing hot. You know, I mean, I have no way of knowing that until it actually goes in front of the, the labs and stuff, you know, but, I mean, chances are when you look at this, it's full of resin, you know, and if there was ever a benign inbred line that's inbred for fiber, not trying to consider, you know, cannabinoid use. This is 100% about fiber use. Yeah. You would think that it shouldn't have a lot of, you know, psychoactive THC. But
are there ways of actually controlling THC levels when plants are in the field, or is it pretty much the genetics are going
to I could have cut all this down before it went to flower.
Okay.
You know, but as soon as the flowers start to happen, you know, that they build up resin no matter what variety it is. It could be fiber, it could be, you know, whatever. And then those resins are full of some kind of cannabinoids. That's just kind of how it goes, you know? And there's no, you know, like, again, but you still have to produce the seeds. Even if you want to grow a fiber crop that in fact, the finest quality Italian textiles were made from very densely planted crops, not grown very tall, and that were not in flower. That's the finest textile
because
grade.
The older the fiber gets,
you have these branches and the branches. Every time you get a branch like this, you have like what's a slub in the textile and stuff. You know what I mean?
So you want it really close together.
Yeah. Like way more dense than this, you know, and not as tall and not gone into flower.
If you were to extrapolate how many seeds per acre you planted here, I know it's not a full acre.
A million.
you would do a million seeds an acre.
Or more. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Which is probably like maybe 50 to 75 pounds.
An acre. 50 is recommended, you know, and with this desert, you're going to lose a lot just because it's so harsh. You know, that's what's kind of cool about this experiment is whatever seeds we collect from here are from the surviving plants that dealt with a pretty harsh situation. So,
so they're going to have
I'm not going to run out and say by any means I'm any kind of breeder, but as far as producing seeds that are potentially going to be
better for this environment,
potentially, you know what I mean? I know it takes generations for real, but at the same time, we're headed in that direction with this, you know, on a certain level, you know.
Right.
But, you know, I'm interested maybe to, you know, see how fresh flowers do in a beer. I kind of like beer, you know what I mean? So maybe work with a local brewer to, like, just get these fresh. Or I've also been acting as a florist lately, too, where, you know, I'm thinking about offering them as fresh flowers, you know,
a bouquet.
Right. And other people want to get the leaves for juices.
Yeah.
And actually, these leaves also have been, you know, they're eaten in Southeast Asian dishes, like Cambodian and Thai people.
Really?
And you know, it's small, and maybe there's some small cannabinoid effect that they get by eating these leaves, but I would say, I would argue it's more about the flavor
and
for the soup.
And
so,
chlorophyll-y,
you know, maybe I can, maybe if any, you know, Thai people want to reach out and, you know, you would have to be, you know, brave to go out there and do it. But but folks are juicing this too. There's like a lot of evidence that people get a lot of relief from all kinds of different things just by juicing the leaves. And certainly it's a huge chlorophyll dose, no matter what.
I mean, absolutely.
It's got to be every bit as good for you as wheatgrass juice, you know.
Yeah. Magnesium, silica, chlorophyll. You've got the phytonutrients, cannabinoids, terpenes, like this.
So it might go in that direction. And here on the farm, I'm probably going to be doing hemp sprouts. I've worked with it a little bit, and I'm doing some R&D on hemp sprouts. And certainly, you know, just keeping genetics going here. It does get quite cold in the winter here, so to keep something going. One of the more challenging things about growing any kind of cannabis in this place is the daylight hours that we have in Southern Arizona. So that's...
What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is these plants, they react to how many daylight hours there are, how many hours of darkness there are in a day.
Okay.
And certain varieties of cannabis will, you know, want to have a flower response. So they won't be able to grow and get big as far as a biomass of the plant. They'll want to always kind of go into flower here. A lot of people I know have experienced that growing in any kind of cannabis in Southern Arizona.
And that's because there's longer periods of darkness?
Yeah, where most of the genetics for modern cannabis are coming from, there's slightly more northern latitudes. They have longer summer days.
Like Humboldt.
They have a couple of, they got like at least another hour and a half on us of like sunlight, you know, which makes a huge, huge, huge difference, you know? So
more cannabinoid production and less likely to go to
right.
To
so that's why typically, like in at least in recreational cannabis here in Arizona, you have a lot of indoor operations. You know, people are scared of our desert sun, our desert soil. But most complicated actually is the number of daylight hours, and I saw that when I did a kind of consultation grow for a couple months in Zimbabwe. Their longest day is only 13 hours. And you also see it in like Colombia, where in order to keep things in a vegetative state, you have lights and stuff. And now we're mostly talking about cannabinoid production. Sure. But even if you want to do fiber, you'd want to pick a variety that, you know, is maybe from the as first furthest south as you could go in China. That would be the place.
Right. Which is what you did.
Right. Right. And then just hope that there's going to be like, everybody talks about auto flower and the recreational thing. This will be like auto veg is what you really want. You know, so you really want like an auto veg to know that the plant is going to grow to a certain height before, you know, it goes into flower so that you have something, especially in the case of fiber. Yeah.
So now in terms of the latest legislation that's out there.
Oh, man.
Before we get into that, though, can you give us kind of a maybe 90-second version of like where hemp has come from and how it's evolved over the last thousands of years to becoming now legal, kind of, and then now almost maybe potentially becoming illegal again, or certain aspects of the plant. Like, maybe give us like that 90-second version of like 10,000 years ago, we started in Mesopotamia growing cannabis, and then evolved with China and this.
Yeah.
And so, like, give us kind of a rundown of like the legal history of hemp and cannabis.
Right. So, you know, going way back, you know, as far as earlier humans, I think there's I don't know exactly the dates, but definitely a couple thousand years ago. Anyways, there's definitely evidence in China and on the Central Asian steppe of definitely use of cannabis for textile and you know, even Iceman going way back, I think I had some cannabis with them in the form of a textile, simple textiles, because yeah, you can actually, you know, just, you know, make something fairly, you know, easily. Once you start messing around with the plant, you can, you know, all of a sudden realize that, you know, you do a couple little things and you've got this thing, you know, this strong thing, just like that, you know what I mean?
So rope.
So right now you can see how this would be very useful when you're out hunting and gathering and stuff, you know, to carry stuff around. I mean, I got my handbag here, you know.
So
it goes way back for clothing and, you know, for carrying stuff around. And then there's definitely evidence of using the flower tops for different things. You know, there's clearly evidence in, I think it's somewhere in Central Asia, a Scythian culture, you know, they kind of like to do what's similar to Mexican Temescal or the Indian sweat lodge thing, where they put herbs on stones. And there's clear 100% clear evidence of that. And then, you know, when, you know, one of the earliest ways human beings would have interacted with this plant right here, right? These are full of seeds, you know, so you're walking around, all of a sudden, you know, you got a snack right here. You know, and then at some point somebody probably, you know, kind of got their hands sticky and then maybe started licking and tasting the gum resin on their hands and stuff. And maybe probably started to eat it before smoking it for sure. You know what I mean? But then felt the medicinal effects of the plant and how it was beneficial. And so then at some point, that goes way, way earlier. But then as society starts to get more and more structured and people want to, you know, put their, you know, their different things in place. I mean, there's modern laws against it. But I think going way, way back, there was maybe some rules in like highly religious societies where perhaps maybe cannabis made some people feel a different way about the ruling religious thoughts in different communities over the human history, and then laws were created in some of those places so that people would have to kind of toe the party line thought as far as, you know, the creation of everything and how that tied into whoever's ideas of their own sense of control of it. It was imposed on other people. And that happened in like going back to like, you know, some of these like heavy Christian or Roman Catholic societies. And
even like prior to that, like Hindu culture, right? Isn't it said that Shiva, like,
Right.
Births out the ganja.
So 100%, right? Like, if we're going to talk about religious cannabis, I know a bunch about it. There is a holy river in India called the Ganges or the Ganga. This is the plant that is put on the banks of the Ganga, the Ganges. And it was there. One of the great gods, you know, God is all one, of course, but then breaks off into a lot of different things in ancient Indian thought, you know. Yeah. And one of the stories about one of these aspects of God is that, you know, this plant was put here on the banks of the Ganga for human beings to use to help feel closer to the feeling of being connected with the creator of everything. So that to this day is respected in extreme religious culture in India to this day, mm-hmm. while marijuana use is illegal in most of India. Maybe there's some mm-hmm. places that have it for medicine, mm-hmm. but it is actually for fiber now in certain places in India. Mm-hmm. But religiously, it's always been somewhat accepted, mostly in the north of India. And it's used, you know, in religious ceremonies and in the east of India too, that for pujas, the bang shops, of course, for drinking bang, which was a drinking preparation mm-hmm. from cannabis. But in the actual pujas, they don't necessarily even use it themselves, mm-hmm. but they'll offer it mm-hmm. to Lord Ganesh, I think, in like Orissa State and some of those places, who's Shiva's son. Mm-hmm. But certainly when you see one of these North Indian sadhus, typically the holy people in India, there are a caste that do use it, mm-hmm. and they use it quite a lot. And
the chilums
and the smoking. Yep. And so it's disrespectful not to, take a hit. And I've actually gone many times to the biggest cannabis consumption event on earth, which is the Mahakumbh Mela in India, where there's 600 million people that come to pray and take a holy dip on the confluence of a few different holy rivers that are coming out of India, one of which is the Ganga. And so using Ganga and Ganja at the Mahakumbh Mela is kind of a part of it, let's say. And so...
If I'm not mistaken, I think it's Sanskrit, but whatever the origin of the word ganja, it translates, the ganj, I think, means tension, and ganja means tension released.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. But certainly it does refer to the mother of goddess of the water, who was actually released from the heavens to come down when there was a disruptful time with some kind of rogue energies running around on the planet. It was asked that she come with her purifying self to heal the planet, and she's considered the mother goddess of all water. And you know, the very weight of her coming from the heavens down to earth required God Shiva himself to actually capture her energy in his dreadlocks, and then that is where the source of the ganja is, from Lord Shiva's dreadlocks, which is why people that believe this kind of stuff, some of them that choose a kind of a stricter, you know, path will not cut their hair and respect for that.
And that's actually,
I give thanks to Jamaican culture and all that, but the reason I wear my hair because I was told by my yoga teacher, who was a Shiva devotee follower, that it'd be best if I didn't cut my hair. Okay. You know, not that I'm that fervent practicer or that nuts about it, but I'm nuts enough to go out. I'm nuts enough to go out to India every 12 years and take a dip when the planets align in a certain way, and that just happened in March. So I was really blessed to run out there for that.
This is speculation, at least on my part. Maybe there's history studies, but when you cut your hair, apparently you have more like psychological problems. So like having longer hair, it almost acts as like antennas to the ethers, which puts you in touch with more of like the psychic receptivity. But anyway, totally other topic.
potentially.
So now kind of getting back into the topic of history, we've gotten into Eastern culture. There's even like African culture, like Shashat, the goddess of mathematics and cannabis. She apparently had a hemp leaf on her crown.
Okay.
Can you talk a little bit about African culture?
I mean, jack of all trades here when it comes to cannabis, but lifeline of experience there with, I was hired to do a job in Zimbabwe. And so I went out there to set up something basically from scratch to get cannabis to happen there. With their new laws, the government was really excited about people coming and investing in cannabis. They were kind of fed the line that, you know, this is going to be, you know, the billions for you guys. Yeah. And you know what I mean? And mostly by recreational cannabinoid people went there and kind of, you know, led the government a bit astray on what the expectations were. Mm-hmm. But some of these companies were getting set up and there was a lot of money being thrown in, especially through like Canada. When Canada went legal, there was all this money to spend on all these crazy projects all over the world. And so I was, uh, I, you know, Me, I'm so into the plant. I love it so much. When somebody offered to pay me to go to Zimbabwe to grow cannabis, I couldn't believe that I wasn't going to have to pay.
Right.
You know what I mean? Because it was like, wow.
Yeah.
You mean you're going to pay me to do that? Right. That's something. When it comes to work, it's like if I wouldn't pay to do something, I kind of almost don't want to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really blessed and honored, and I went out there, and Zimbabwe is pretty intense, and their history is pretty intense, and. Mm-hmm. There are kind of some difficult things about the whole situation in terms of like human interactions and resources between management and the people I worked with. But what I did find out was all the genetics that we had here were not going to work there without supplemental lighting. It was just like the 13-hour day was it. So there is a culture in northern Zimbabwe, Matonga people, cannabis a lot. And then through in Shona tradition, which was the main kind of, you could say, tribe or language group in Zimbabwe, Shona people were like using, there's an animist religion there. It's heavily Christian, evangelistic kind of Christian, but there's still a deep belief in witchcraft. And so, witch doctors and witches and whatnot will use plant compounds for their different healing techniques or different incantations. They'll use these different things. Cannabis was always used in a case of white magic against kind of dark magic.
Mm.
So cannabis was considered like a super big ally in the fight against bad vibes.
Okay.
And so I did experience directly some pretty heavy vibes with that. And and because I was there to kind of show people how to grow a lot of cannabis, it almost, I kind of felt like, at least revered by some for, having that skill and connection and vibration with the plant. So on that sense, while there's a lot of difficult stuff having to do with racism and everything else and what white skin represents to most people that are, Shona in Zimbabwe, there's a lot to overcome and race relations, let's just say. Mm-hmm. But, saying thank you and hello and would you please, and when you're asking somebody to do something, came off as being helpful. And I see that in my travels, like whenever I go to a new place, goodbye, please, thank you are huge ones,
Absolutely.
And so, but then, to take it another step and be growing what's considered a sacred medicine, let's just say, I got me a nickname, Mr. Logo, which is dreads. And so when the world locked down and COVID happened, I happened to be out there on that farm for a solid 6 months.
Wild.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So I got to experience COVID lockdown there. And fortunately for me, it was just me and my friends out there working on this thing. All upper management were locked out of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to kind of do my own thing and really experience how to grow, cannabis, and what the best kind of cannabis, of course, is the local stuff that they have already out there. And there's reasons why you grow certain varieties of cannabis in certain places and for certain uses, So depending on what you want as the end product, there's, varieties that are really important, in the case of Zimbabwe, we've all seen the National Geographic termite mounds that are, as big as somebody's house. And that is the case. And you figure if they can munch on that, 100-foot tree over there, it can definitely make quick work of your plants.
Sure,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, some of the local genetics weren't doing that.
Interesting.
So
to kind of rein it back in and get into
far out,
the latest legislation and laws. Like, what is your understanding of what's been written, what's been proposed, and what that could potentially lead to, kind of what the status
so it's all about the redefinition of what cannabis sativa is, cannabis sativa, and then what is going to be allowed to be called hemp. It's all cannabis sativa, right? Let's just say, people talk about indica, ruderalis, whatever.
Yeah.
Let's just go back and say it's all cannabis sativa, one species, right?
Yeah.
As far as hemp, we're talking about a definition that talks about the chemotype or the chemicals that are in the plant itself. And the current definition is a plant that has 0.3% tetrahydrocannabinol, THC, delta-9, 0.3% or higher is considered marijuana, mm-hmm. and everything less than that is considered industrial hemp, mm-hmm. as far as the current law goes.
Yeah.
Now, 0.3% of chemical compound is very little, yeah. right? There's a lot of confusion because the plant doesn't actually produce delta-9 THC. It produces tetrahydrocannabinolic acid, yeah. right?
THCA.
Which needs to get heated in order to become delta-9 THC, yeah. right? Yeah. And become psychoactive, right? Yeah. So right away, it took a couple years for people to figure this out when hemp first became legal and these definitions were carried over from European laws is mm-hmm. where these laws were first, you know, came into mm-hmm. effect for European grain crop and yeah. European fiber crops and stuff. Yeah. So that was the legal cannabis under the EU rules. We kind of adapted that. But
do you want to switch spots so the sun's on your other side of your sure. face?
Am I getting burned?
Just in case. Okay, so we adopted the EU kind of definitions.
Yeah, people figured out quickly that it took a little while that all cannabis doesn't mostly produce delta 9,
yeah.
right? So then some people meant that in their minds and in some legal opinions' minds mm-hmm. made all of marijuana legal, essentially, yeah. you know? Yeah. So
you said legal.
Legal, yeah. yeah
so because it didn't yeah. if you tested it, the THC and level was below.
And then when it comes to the, you know, ag departments and stuff, they're only concerned with growing it. They're not really concerned with the sales of it so much, you know. Yeah. I mean, outside of a few rules or whatever, there's mm-hmm. pretty much they don't regulate what gets smoked in the smoke shop, what gets sold in the gas stations and stuff. Yeah. So all of a sudden cannabis that was being grown on hemp farms, the licensed hemp farms, all of a sudden started showing up in intoxicating products and yeah. smoke shops and stuff. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so the problem is that it doesn't even, the problem is it's illegal in the first place. That, yeah. That's the problem, right? Yeah. Because
schedule.
So what, you know, if these things are for sale, maybe yeah. perhaps they shouldn't be sold to children or something. You know uh-huh. what I mean? It's yeah. kind of my opinion.
Of
you know,
course.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And as far as who grows it and how it's grown and all that, as long as you're selling a good, clean product, this isn't poisonous. You know what mm-hmm. I mean?
Yeah.
By all means, you know, it should be available. And
exactly.
And so, that's a radical opinion or whatever. But you know,
maybe,
I mean,
yeah.
grow it nice and have it available for sale yeah. anywhere. You know,
right. I mean, you grow poppy seeds. I mean, you grow cotton, tomatoes. Like it is an agricultural crop.
Right.
What you do with it's one thing, and certainly regulating the psychoactive components is necessary. Like, we don't want this getting into the hands of
but lightly, you know, it's like not any yeah. more than alcohol. Certainly, I guess even alcohol is kind of strict as far as, you know, the liquor licenses and stuff like that. And I'm not so sure that a farmer should be burdened with, you know, all this licensing to grow yeah. a crop. It just right. needs to be grown and you know,
the regulation should happen more in the market, not so right. much in the fields.
Right.
That's kind of the point.
Yeah. Because here's the problem now, right? With this new definition, they're saying, okay, I think they're up a point of a percent. I heard it's something like 0.4 now, which doesn't mean anything.
No.
But what it does change is now instead of the delta 9 cannabinoid, it's all THC compounds, and there's several different kinds of THC, mm-hmm. but especially the THC now.
THCV, THCA.
Well, that THC. Will knock out pretty much everything. I'm guessing that, I mean, I could be wrong, that these plants that were only supposed to be fiber plants, I'm guessing that because of the resins that are building up on these seed pods,
yeah.
it's possible that now this would be illegal, which is absolutely mm-hmm. criminal ridiculous. Now,
yeah.
so many people have gotten relief from a CBD chemical compound.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was bred probably from plants that were high in THC. Maybe they were bred with fiber crops, but mm-hmm. I kind of almost don't think so. I just kind of yeah. think that those were the unicorn plants that had high levels of CBD, low levels of THCA,
yeah.
and they became the ancestors of the cherry wines and
yeah.
all the stuff that was used to make, you know, the CBD products.
Yeah.
And now all those will, they won't, you know, they won't make it. And then the products being made from them for sure won't make it either, because what they're talking about is container amounts. Like you can only have 0.4 in a whole container. So there's no, there's no plants out there that are going to keep the levels that low. The only thing you can make, you can't grow them. That's the problem. Yeah. Right. So
it's not natural.
Yeah. So it's,
so
it's,
what do you think needs to happen between now and a year from now, when they've pushed it out a year, the legislation's not in place yet. We have a year to...
Well, the definition needs to be changed, you know, 100%, you know.
The legal...
Yeah, I mean, what needs to happen is...
Definition.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if we're smart enough as a human race to just be like, hey, let's just free up the plant and let people do what they do with it, you know. That's what needs to happen.
Yeah.
You know?
That's the ideal situation.
Yeah.
So, let the plant free.
Get free it up, you know what I mean? And let the market decides who gets to play, you know, who gets to play with it. Don't make, like in Arizona, we have very strict, restrictive, basically monopolized system when it comes to the, you know, recreational use of like the cannabinoid and even therefore the medicinal side of it. It's all kind of a corrupt monopoly system in our state here, you know. So
so what can people do state by state? What actions could they take between now and the potential legislation?
Well, certainly if there's any kind of local group that's doing something and it's reasonable, you know, to get involved with that group, you know, do your investigation homework. Hopefully those groups will allow for participation for folks that, you know, let's say there's like, I think, you know, if there's an industry group, like we had the Hemp Industries Association. Mm-hmm. We started all this big fight way back in the early 90s with Christy Bowling and all these guys. And like I said, Jack Herrick, Chris Conrad, all the old timers, Eric Steenstra. So there's too many to
Candy Penn.
So many to Candy Penn, Mary Kane, like Steve Levine.
Yeah.
So many people. Yeah. It's too way too many to mention. Richard Lee,
of course.
Steve D'Angelo, of course. Yeah. All these guys, you know. Yep.
And the Bronners, of course.
The Bronners, later when they came through, and certainly putting their money where their mouth was. And we fought the DEA for hemp food.
Mm-hmm.
Right, we they weren't gonna let us have this grain here, right?
Yeah.
These grains to eat, right? They weren't gonna let us have this, you know. Mm-hmm. And we got this freed up. It still needed to come from Canada.
Mm-hmm. Unbelievable,
right? But the reason we had it available to us is because you could smash the shell off and just get the nut out of it, right? Mm-hmm. This was called the hemp heart or the hemp nut, you know.
Yeah.
I guess that was a trademark term with some controversy, but the hemp heart is here, and there was a machine to smash the crack the hole off, because one of the rules with industrial hemp was you can bring the, you know, seed meals and stuff, but you can't bring the viable seed, because then you can grow it. So
You could import every product
early,
legally,
before the hemp heart. Actually, interestingly enough, you could go to a lot of feed stores and get hemp that was coming in from different countries, but there was the DEA would watch the shipment go to a steam, they would steam
distillation,
or they would run it through some kind of steam thing, and kill the germination possibility of these seeds.
Yeah.
So when this food came through, we had to fight for the right to use this Canadian product in our food, and now I don't know, there's a big industry obviously, and you can go to Whole Foods and get all kinds of hemp products, but we actually had to fight for that, and I personally, you know, did a, you know, a lot of work to make that happen with the, along with David and Eric especially, you know, so
John Rulak I think was a big part of that.
Those guys way more, you know, kind of every day able to articulate it better than me. But certainly all of us in the Hemp Industries Association work together on that, you know.
Absolutely. So to kind of come full circle and wrap up the hempisode, and thank you so much for being a huge part of this movement. What if you were to share a message with every human being on the planet? You could whisper into their ear one thing about hemp or anything that you would want them to know. What would that message be that you would want them to hear?
I mean, beyond hemp and everything, we're all human beings, man, on this planet, and just try to feel, you know, a peace with the creator of everything, and realize that, you know, you are, you know, loved, you know, the universe is out there, created you, and, you know, do the best you can to do your duty on this earth and your service, and not be attached really too much to the fruits of it, you know, and just kind of do and live together and try, you know, part of that is being peaceful with one another, you know? So I would say that this planet has enough resources for everybody. Hemp is a big part of giving us so many resources, food and fiber, fuel, medicine, recreation. So, you know, keep informed with all that hemp is and all that hemp could be for you, and do what you can to keep it freed up, and just, again, help keep peace in your life with whatever it takes for you to do that, you know.
Absolutely. That's beautiful. It.
Yeah.
Thank you, bro. Appreciate you. How can people find you? Where can they go online to hire
you? So I have Crucial Organics. Crucial Organics is now the latest incarnation of me messing around on Instagram. You know what I mean? It's kind of fun. Okay. So you can see some of my little folly there and whatnot. And I do have Crucial Hemp still.
Okay.
So I may do a relaunch of some textile stuff. But for the time being, we just have our, you know, CBD line. It's a full spectrum extract, which, you know, probably wouldn't make it in the new law. Yeah, because of the amount of THC that's in it. Even though overall weight per gram is less than 0.3% THC anything, it's still, by the time you have a bottle full of it, it's going to be enough to be an illegal product, you know.
Right.
So,
crazy.
So
Crucial Hemp.
Crucial Organics AZ is the Instagram, and I also have a website, Crucial Organics.
And if people want to hire you for consultations,
I'll travel, you know, I'll definitely travel. So I'm happy to do projects. You know, I'm kind of done a lot of these things where there's nothing there, and we go in and we set up a viable project with as, you know, limited, you know, inputs as possible, or local inputs is kind of a specialty. I like finding local inputs and trying to do things naturally and inexpensively, you know.
Exactly. So right on.
Yeah.
Thanks everyone for tuning in to another Hempisode of HempAware Radio. We'll see you on the next one. Peace out.
All right. Cool. All right.